The American dream has become a nightmare. Signs of the time are on cardboard on corners in town, like a cancer that silently spreads. There's an unspoken fear, we're on our way down. We must take America back, Main Street to Wall Street, cities and states, Washington, D.C., before it's too late, there's not long. We need leaders who lead us, not stick us and bleed us, then ransom our future and our children's, that's wrong. We must take America back as liberty weeps, our forefathers spin in their graves. Pray God will bless some way out of this mess. We must take America back.
Our newest CMOD is all about the Vikings in Greenland 1,000 years ago. And the let me just give a 30-second summary. The archaeological and other historical information on the Viking settlement in Greenland 1,000 years ago, about 5,000 Vikings were living there in 1150. This is a very successful settlement. That the archaeological, anthropological, historical information proves that Greenland was much warmer 1,000 years ago than it is today. And by the way, that's before I drove my SUV. Okay, my SUV didn't make a lick of difference. How do we know Greenland was much warmer? Well, there's all kinds of evidence. A lot of it Mike Kaufman presented in terms of scientific data. But there's also some very, very interesting archaeological data. Example, the Greenlanders who died and were buried early in the settlement, around 1,050, stood 5 feet 7 inches tall on average. Okay, these were pretty big people, men and women average. By the end of the settlements, their height was 5 feet at most. Why was their height so short? It's because the climate was getting cold, so cold, they were malnourished. The priests, by the way, it was so successful, the Catholic Church created a diocese in Greenland. How many of you read that in your history books? Okay, Catholic diocese in Greenland. They sent a number of bishops, number of priests to serve the diocese. And a number of these priests wrote home and described what was happening. One of them said, writing in about 1150, that we now have icebergs. Didn't used to have them before. And because of all the icebergs, we've had to change our sailing routes because it's too dangerous navigating among the icebergs. Okay, they describe how Greenland, that once had lush pastures, all kinds of food, lots of cattle, sheep, goats, now had such short growing seasons that people were starving. They tell us that the codfish no longer came close enough for the nets because the water was so cold. It just goes on and on and on. Now, here's the kicker. In neighboring Iceland, there's a record of a farmer who went to a neighboring island 2 miles away to get a sheep. He didn't have a boat, so what do you guess he did? He swam, okay? 2 miles, got the sheep, swam back with the sheep, all right? Could you do that today? Not without a wetsuit. I wonder how common wetsuits were, you know, about 1100 A.D. The water was much, much warmer. 1000 A.D., commonly referred to, okay, commonly referred to as the optimum, okay, the Middle Ages optimum. Why is it referred to as that? It's because the temperature was warm. You know what warm temperature means? It means lots of rain. It means long growing season. It means you have food. That's when the Vikings were in Greenland. So anyway, I put out this news release on that 2 days ago saying archaeological research on Greenland demonstrates that man-made global warming is false. So if you want to follow the hate mail over the next week, Go for it. Now, all this is documented on cmods.org. The one before that was on the ancient maps. Let me give you just a 60-second description of that. In the last 60 years, there have been three ancient maps uncovered that are maps of Antarctica, okay? Maps of Antarctica, all drawn before Antarctica was discovered, quote unquote. All right? All drawn before Antarctica was discovered. One of the maps, dated shortly after 1500, says it was based on source maps going back to the time of Alexander the Great, 330 BC. All right? Another map drawn at about the same time is very, very similar. It shows Antarctica on the coastline as being ice-free. Ice-free. One of the maps shows Antarctica divided into two land masses. We didn't know that until 1953 when sonogram readings determined there were two land masses. Okay, these are some of the highlights. What does this tell us? It tells us for certain. Nobody questions the authenticity of these maps. Nobody. It tells us for certain that 2,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago, 3,000 years ago, we don't know the exact time, but not that long ago, Antarctica, at least on the coastline, was ice-free, and one map says it was ice-free enough so people knew there were two land masses. All right? I'm just going to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, this is historical fact. This is not my opinion. This is historical fact. CMods.org, read all about it. So we put out an advisory on that saying, ancient maps disprove global warming. And that really got under the skin of the lefties. And we're going to continue to get on their skin, under their skin, partly because it's so much fun. Actually, just putting the information out. You know, all people need is information. All people need is information. If the American public just knew the information in these two curriculum modules, on the Vikings 1,000 years ago and on Antarctica 2,000, 3,000 years ago, if the American people knew that information, okay, the climate bill would be dead in its tracks. People just need information. So go to cmods.org and you can read all about it. Now, like I said, I've chosen to speak on what's been happening in the last 3 weeks. Because there's a very big story, a huge story, that is coming out that we knew was there, but we didn't have the hard copy and we couldn't prove it. Okay, and EdWatch, and we're very, very careful because we get over 1 million hits a year. All right? And when you have that kind of visibility, you are very careful to be exact and be able to document everything that you say. So we weren't going to come forward with this until we had the smoking gun. 3 weeks ago, the smoking gun came out of the closet. And so today I can give you the speech that I really wanted to give. And that is on the revolution is here. And we're going to talk about education. Our field is education. Okay, we're the teachers. In Minnesota, I'm known primarily as a politician, but that's not who I am. I am a educator. I am a teacher. I'm going to start with some, a combination of what's been happening along with some background material. 2 days ago, Glenn Beck on his radio talk show said, this is August 11, 2009, that we are witnessing a worldwide paradigm shift, worldview shift, okay, idea shift. A worldwide revolution. Glenn Beck is absolutely correct in what he's saying. And ladies and gentlemen, I think you all have a sense that the revolution in particular is happening in the United States of America. Yes, it is worldwide. It is worldwide, but the radicals of the world know that the United States is only the real bastion of freedom in the world. Okay. How do I know that? Because I read the publications of the UN. Okay. I don't read what the conservatives say. I always want to just read what the radicals say. I mean, the books, if you read, UN University Press, buy their books. There is, by the way, there is no university, but there is a press. UN University Press, okay? Lots of books that say very bluntly, the United States is the target. Okay, they assume global government. They don't argue it. They assume it. What's it going to look like? How are we going to get there? We have to bring the United States under control. Okay, all of this, Agenda 21, Earth Charter, it's all targeted at the United States. Other countries in their stupidity sign on, but it's all targeted at the United States. So that's what Glenn Beck said. He's absolutely correct in what he said. Background, America is the only major country of the world founded on ideas. All right? What is America? We think a government, we think a people, we think of geography. Ladies and gentlemen, more than any of these things, America is an idea. America is an idea. This is the battleground for freedom. It's the battle of ideas. And this is where we win or we lose. It is in the battle of ideas. Let's start with where we have come from. Now, the title said the revolution is here. Keep in mind, we fought a war for revolution over 200 years ago. That was a revolution leaving tyranny and going to freedom. The revolution today is the opposite. The revolution today is the revolution from freedom to tyranny. That's what it is. In our schools, we need to teach the 12 pillars of freedom. These are the ideas upon which our nation was built. They are the ideas summarized in the Declaration of Independence. Okay, they're all contained there. They were written by John Locke. They were written by Thomas Paine. They are written in Romans chapter 1, Romans chapter 2, Romans chapter 12, and the book of Genesis. All right, they all played a key role. I'm going to mention just the first two, and then I'm going to summarize the rest, because I know some of you remember this was the topic of my address last year. It was the 12 Pillars of Freedom. By the way, you don't have to listen to anything I say. Just go to cmods.org. Curriculum module, 12 Pillars of Freedom. It's a lesson plan. Here's how you teach it. But just very, very quickly, as a refresher, first principle stated in the Declaration, if you did a man in the street, okay, microphone, hi, George, can you tell me what is the first fundamental principle of our country as stated in the Declaration? Will 1 in 100 Americans know? I don't think so. Will 1 in 1,000 know? I don't think so. First principle of freedom stated in the Declaration, let's read it from the Declaration. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station. What is that? It is what we call national sovereignty. Principle number one. Our country is committed, number one, numero uno, to being a free, independent, sovereign nation. That's number one. This is where we start. You could just as well call the Declaration of Independence the Declaration of National Sovereignty. That's what it is. This is where we start. By the way, I teach government at the college level. I ask my students, how many of you have learned any part of the Declaration of Independence? 20 years ago, two-thirds had learned at least some. Today, almost none of them have learned any of it. Very seldom. And they started with the second paragraph, which is a mistake. Start with the first. Principle number two, to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, we call that natural law, the universal moral code that governs all people for all time. The universal moral code is the other side of the coin of human rights. There are no human rights without moral law. They are two sides of the same coin. I want to repeat that. There are no human rights, none, without moral law. They are two sides of the same coin. Why is it wrong to kill somebody? Because that person has a right to live. Why is it wrong to steal? Because people have a right to private property. They are the two sides of the same coin. Now, CMODS.org, I'm just going to read the other 10. Genuine truth, equality, God-given rights of life, liberty, property. Government exists to protect our rights. That means limited government. Popular sovereignty, that means the people rule. 11, federalism and states' rights. Number 12, divine providence. I bet there isn't one person in 20, maybe not one in 100 in our country that knows that the Declaration of Independence ends with an appeal to divine providence. Why did this little band of rebels think that they could go up against the greatest economic and military force in the world and win? They said, we can win because God is on our side, or we are on God's side. That's where it ends. Okay, these are the 12 principles of freedom. Now, the leftists, okay, the people on the other side, ladies and gentlemen, reject every one of the 12. They reject every one. And I don't have time to go into that in detail. How will America remain free? Ladies and gentlemen, we will remain free only one way. There are a lot of skirmishes we have to fight, but we will remain free only one way, and that is by winning the war of ideas. That is the only way. And we will win or lose the war of ideas in the field of education. It's not the only place, but that's the primary place. It's the primary place. Now, let me give you the bad news. Let me tell you what actually is happening. And I'm going to tell you some things you've never heard before. Trust me, it's all true. Do the research, okay? Go ahead and check. Everything I say eventually goes on our website. We'll have all kinds of people that'll criticize if they think it's wrong. It's not wrong. The intellectual godfather of the left at the on the university campuses, okay, here's what the teachers are being taught. At the teachers' colleges, wherever they are. The intellectual guru is not Karl Marx, even though he has an input. It's not John Dewey, even though John Dewey's had a tremendous impact. The worst boogeyman is not the NEA, even though I will tell you, the NEA hates me with a passion that I wish I could emulate for my dear wife, okay, in a good sense. But the intellectual guru on the university campus is an Italian Marxist by the name of Antonio Gramsci. And ladies and gentlemen, when you can, Google the name Gramsci, G-R-M-A-M-S-C-I, and Google the words on education, and his essay, 22 pages on education, will come up. Ladies and gentlemen, everything that is happening in the schools today is outlined and recommended in Gramsci's essay on education. Everything is there. So, for instance, David Horowitz, who was raised as a communist, one of the most astute observers of our country today, then says very frankly that Gramsci is the thought guru of the colleges and universities. Absolutely right. Now, Gramsci is a Marxist, but he says Karl Marx was wrong when he said that economics controls the world. And he said Karl Marx was wrong when he thought by taking over the economic system, you could take over the world. Gramsci says that's not the way it is. Gramsci says the revolution will be brought about not by taking over economics, but by taking over the culture, sometimes called cultural Marxism. You take over the culture. How do you take over the culture? Gramsci said you do it two ways. Number one, you control the media. The radicals have the media for the most part. Number two, you do it by taking over the schools. And he goes into great detail on how you do it in the schools, and it is exactly what is happening today in our country. So Gramsci said educational must be transformational, okay? All of the teachers in the public schools today accept transformational education. That is, the goal of education is not to impart information and academic skills. The goal of education is to transform, change the student, that is, change the attitudes, the values, and the worldview of the child. Ladies and gentlemen, all the teachers, I suppose you can find one here and there who says, I don't believe that. But I talk to teachers. I go to their teachers' conferences. We converse. They all accept this. Goal of education is transformation. And then you have all the God slogans that are out there today. Teachers are not to be the sage on the stage. They're to be the guide on the side. That's straight out of Gramsci. The preoccupation with group projects, which Gramsci said are necessary to accomplish group consciousness. Students think of themselves not as an individual, but as a member of a group. All of these things are designed to produce the revolutionary global citizen that Gramsci described. All right? Now, fast forward to how this is being put in place today. I'd like to make some very quick comments on how this is being put in place today. Our Secretary of Education is a guy by the name of Arne Duncan, appointed by Obama. And there's a lot I could say about him. I'm going to be very, very quick and just say straight out, Arne Duncan, in no way, shape, or form, is qualified to be U.S. Secretary of Education. And it blows my mind that the Republicans in the House and the Senate don't raise Cain about Obama having a Secretary of Education who in no way is qualified to be Secretary of Education. First of all, his academic field, okay, his academic field was sociology. It wasn't education. His life goal was to be a basketball coach. Hey, I've got nothing against basketball coaches, but that doesn't equip you to be a Secretary of Education. If he has an advanced degree, it is the best kept secret on Google and Yahoo. I don't think there is one. What is his real credential? His real credential is he was playing basketball with Barack Obama the morning of the inauguration. I mean, he's a very, very close friend of Barack Obama. What did Obama say was his qualification? His qualification was that he was CEO of Chicago Schools. CEO. Is that kind of like a superintendent or principal? CEO of Chicago Schools. Well, he was appointed by none other than Richard M. Daley. All right. To be CEO of Chicago Schools, which equipped him to go on other things. And the individual in charge of appointments at that time was one Robert Sorich. On July 5th, 2006, according to the Chicago Tribune, Sorich was convicted on two counts of mail fraud for rigging city jobs and promotions. All right? The Chicago Sun said, and I quote, Mayor Daley's former patronage chief, Robert Sorich, was sentenced to 46 months for his role in a corrupt city hall hiring scheme, the $40 million hired truck scandal. I'd love to go into that. It's great fun, but I won't. It's been little more than a jobs program for the outfit. The outfit is the Chicago branch of organized crime. All right? That's what the Chicago Sun said. So, was this a political appointment to appoint Sorich to be CEO of Chicago Schools? I won't answer that question. I'll just raise it. Then you had David Axelrod, who during the trial wrote an op-ed piece saying, political appointments are a good thing. Implication being Sorich is being prosecuted, and we know it's the law, but it's a bad law because political appointments are a good thing. And David Axelrod actually argued that a well-oiled political machine requires political appointments. All right. So anyway, he's not qualified to do anything good, so why is he there? He is a puppet for the plan. All right? Now, that's my inference. You don't have to agree with that. but I think it's pretty fair inference. All right. Here we get to the guts of the matter. On July 24th, 2009, United States Department of Education, this is the smoking gun, announced that the centerpiece, and I quote now, of the Obama administration's education reform efforts in its $4.35 billion race to the top, this is stimulus money, will include adopting, notice the language here, internationally benchmarked education standards. Okay, the article also clarified that these will be national standards, keyed to the international standards, and states will be incentivized. You know what that means? You do what department wants, and they give you the money. All right? So stimulus money being used to push these standards. Now, they can use the language standards because the public doesn't know what standards mean. What are national standards? The public thinks this means something about achievement. In education, in this context, national standards have nothing to do with achievement. National standards mean curriculum. National standards means this is what you have to teach. All right? So what this press release means is the Obama administration is going to use the stimulus money to get schools to teach what it wants taught. Ladies and gentlemen, that is not my opinion. Well, it is my opinion, but I mean, that's what it is. That's what it is. There is no other explanation. Now, how are we going to do this? Well, there's been a bill sitting in Congress now for several years that explains how they're going to do it, and they will bring it forward when they want. This bill has had as its authors all of the chief Democrats on the Education Committee, both houses. You know this is where they're going to go. Here's how they intend to do it. They are going to have a national test and national curriculum that will be written by what I call the NAG Board, the National Assessment Governing Board. Okay? This board already exists. And this single board, according to the bill that's been sitting there, they're going to move it when they're ready. This one single board will dictate the curriculum in every school in the country. Now, guess how the members of this board are chosen? You think there's anybody we're ever going to vote on? Every member of the NAG board is appointed by the president. Every member of the NAG board serves at the beck and call of the president of the United States. So we have now totally bypassed checks and balances. We have totally bypassed any kind of popular sovereignty when the President of the United States can tell all the schools this is what you have to teach. Now, it's not just what they're going to teach. It's also a national test. There's another bill sitting there that says no student is eligible for college until they pass the national test, written by the NAG board. This is how they intend to catch private school students and homeschool students, all right? If you can't pass the test, you can't go to college. Now, the National Governors Association, and by the way, I've worked with a number of governors, and I've yet to work with one who knew anything about education, okay? Let me just leave it at that. They are enabling the Obama people by calling for, quote-unquote, voluntary national education standards. I think you know how much the word voluntary means when it comes to the federal government. Goals 2000 was voluntary too, but schools were told, oh, by the way, if you don't do it, you're going to lose all your federal education money, 8% of the total. Why do you think all states signed on to voluntary goals 2000? Because they would lose all their education money if they didn't. I'm sure they intend the same thing with this. Okay, now, these are going to be internationally benchmark standards, according to the press release. Now, keep in mind the standards mean curriculum. Standards mean curriculum. Standards mean this is what you want to teach. Because this is my field, I know immediately what is meant by internationally benchmarked education standards. The only such standards that exist that are comprehensive are the standards put together by UNESCO. There are no other comprehensive standards. I mean, there are some piecemeal things here and there. But UNESCO has the standards. Now, this doesn't surprise me because I'm author of the book, Fed Ed, the New Federal Curriculum and How It's Enforced. What the news release didn't say is that the standards are already written. Okay, I describe them in great detail in my book, Fed Ed. If you don't have it, you can pick it up in the back. Okay, the only problem with that book is it was 7 years ahead of its time. But it goes in every academic area and says, here's what the standards say. I've read them all. Here's what they say. All right? The only internationally benchmarked standards that exist, they're comprehensive, are put together by UNESCO. Okay, Google UNESCO. One of the things you can go is go to education standards. They've got a subtitle, education standards. You can read the UNESCO education standards. Guess what? UNESCO education standards, among other things, say all of the treaties and the agreements of the UN are part of the UNESCO education standards. It's exactly what it says. So that means everything in Agenda 21, everything in the Earth Charter, everything in the rights of the child, all go into the education standards. Their statement of human rights, the UDHR, is part of the standards. According to what they say, take them at their word. This is what they say. So, let's consider what the questions will look like. True or false? Start with this one. United States citizens have an individual right to bear arms. Guess what? Guess what the national standards say? No. According to the written, I go into it in detail in my book, Fed Ed, standards, national standards say is the right to bear arms is limited to militias. No individual right to bear arms. So you get a knowledgeable private school student, a knowledgeable homeschool student gets that question, and unless they know how to play some game here, they're going to answer it incorrectly. Free enterprise is the economic system that works. I think you can see this one. National standards say free enterprise has its advantages, but it creates tremendous income disparities. And so we're left with all these poor people, blah, 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 blah. Correct answer to this question is going to be false, according to the standards. United States citizens have an inalienable, or if you prefer the term unalienable, let's say God-given, let's be blunt, have a God-given right to free speech. Shaw went over this. UDHR says you don't have any rights unless the UN says you do. There are no God-given rights in the UN system. Zero. Let's say God-given rights, all right? Same thing with right to property. There are no God-given rights in the UN system. So this is, in part, this is just a preview, just a little bit of what we're looking at. International Baccalaureate. Go to their website, see their definition. They're going to tell you two things. They're going to tell, by the way, International Baccalaureate is in partnership with UNESCO. And that is being in partnership with the 900-pound gorilla. I mean, if you're in partnership with the UN is calling the shots. You know where the tests for International Baccalaureate are graded? Try Geneva. You know where they're graded, okay? IB comes into a school and they say, gee, you can set your own curriculum. And so their spokesmen tell the public, you know, not a problem. You can set your own curriculum. What they don't tell you is that the contract says, aha. But if you're an IB school, you must teach the attitudes and values of the UN in every class, okay? In every class. Do you have freedom of speech? You join IB. You sign a contract that says there will be no criticism of IB. All right, it's right in the contract. Right in the contract. International Baccalaureate, look at their website. Say, number one, it's an international system of education. Number two, its purpose is to create world citizens. Okay, are these citizens that are going to be committed to the 12 pillars of freedom? No way. World citizens, they're going to relate to the UN, not to the United States. Washington Post a number of years ago said, IB is the prototype for international education. That's absolutely true. IB is the prototypes, all being developed. The materials now are being written by UNESCO. Okay, this is the prototype. We lament the fact that terrorists are being trained inside our borders. Ladies and gentlemen, UN education is being developed, the prototype, inside our borders with our tax money. So this is, in a nutshell, what we are facing. Because of time constraints, I'm going to stop there, except to talk with you just very, very briefly about what are we going to do. Okay, what are we going to do? Number one, at the national level, we have to start talking to candidates and elected officials, etc., about what schools should teach. And this is going to be things like, do you think our schools should be teaching the 12 pillars of freedom? Well, what are they? Hand them out. Take them off our web page. Write out of our declaration. Or put it this way, do you think our schools should be teaching the Declaration of Independence? I'm going to love to see a candidate out there that if you go after him, is going to say, no, I don't think our schools should teach the meaning of the Declaration of Independence. And not teach as a historical curiosity, but teach as something that's real, that is who we really are. We need to do that. Ladies and gentlemen, we have to have town hall-type meetings with our school boards. Do you think the school boards know what's going on? Very few. There are some good people here and there. For the most part, the school boards don't have a clue. Okay? Here's the information. Here's the information. Go to the school boards. School board members, do you think our school should be teaching the 12 Pillars of Freedom, meaning the Declaration of Independence? Is it being taught? Boy, I don't know. Ladies and gentlemen, I will guarantee you, it is not being taught. It is not being taught in the schools. Is the Bill of Rights being taught as a model for human rights to our kids? I will guarantee to you, ladies and gentlemen, it is not being taught. It is not being taught. We need to go to the school boards and say, this school is going to aggressively teach the ideas that have made us the greatest country in the history of the world. And if you school board members aren't willing to do that, we are going to find some who will. Okay? We're going to need some gutsy people to do what's right. I see my time is up here, so let me close with two very, very quick things. Ladies and gentlemen, again, the battle for freedom is the battle of ideas. I mean, this is it. There are other skirmishes, but this is it. It's the battle for ideas. And so as Abraham Lincoln, at the close of his Gettysburg Address, who called on the country after the tremendous battle of the Civil War to commit itself to a new birth of freedom. Ladies and gentlemen, are we willing to do that? Are we ready to do that? To commit ourselves to a new birth of freedom as opposed to the tyranny to which we're headed. How about it? Everybody? Let's do it. And second, I want you to know that in spite of his personal problems, I'm a Mel Gibson fan, Braveheart, okay? I mean, I know his personal problems, but Braveheart, okay? He's on the slab being murdered, and he's asked to cry out. Just ask for mercy. Ask for mercy. What does he do? Freedom. He cries out for freedom! All right? Are we there? We need to do it. God bless. That might be better.
We'll be right back. And the last one for this afternoon is Mr. Michael Chapman. Michael Chapman is a member of the board of directors of EdWatch and the premier, which is the premier education watchdog in America. He uses his extensive collection of rare founding-era books to reveal widespread bias and censorship within America's history curriculum. He has conducted research for state legislators as well as U.S. congressmen. In addition to speaking at conferences all over the country, including one in Tulsa, Oklahoma, as our guest, which we were delighted to have, he has conducted teacher in-service training on worldview bias in several states and has been a co-speaker with Minnesota Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann. He's also recently, as he just told me today, been the recipient of the highest award that Ted Baer of Movie Guide Review can give. It was the Templeton Award. It was a four-star rating. I was going to give you an Academy Award. There you go. Anyway, his video, he'll take it. His DVD, America's Censored Heritage, has been given the highest award, which was 4 stars, the highest rating. So we can't encourage you enough to pick up that DVD and then share it with your school teachers that you know. And without any further ado, Michael Chapman.
Thank you so much. It's good to be back here for my sixth year in a row, I think. Some of you will have seen some of this. It'll be some review, but I'm going to connect it to what's going on. What I want to say about what Alan talked about is, in reality, the national standards have always been based on the international standards. It's been in place for about 9 years. A lot of the curriculum reviews that I've done have proven that, and we're going to look at a little bit of how that got done prior to Agenda 21. And if you think about it, Lincoln also, as long as we're quoting Lincoln, he is attributed with saying the philosophy of the school in one generation will become the philosophy of government in the next. So why would we be surprised if, in fact, I just lost power. Excuse me, just lost power. It looks like it's back. So why would we be surprised that the enemy didn't circle the wagons around behind us and start to train their army against us? You know, we fight these battles on an adult world, but the children are the future warriors to fight the battles for them. And that's what I think we're facing, and why most of the agenda of sustainable development is complete within education. Remember, we are in the middle of UNESCO's declared decade of education for sustainable development that is supposed to be completely in place by 2015. Among their goals is to integrate sustainable development into all levels of education in order to promote education as a key agent for change. This is about education for change, transformation, as Alan explained. They also said that the plan presents three key areas of sustainable development: the society, the environment, and the economy. These are the three pillars that make up the sustainable development area as it pertains to education. And it calls for lifelong learning, that is, you will never be done with them even after you graduate, and calls for a reorienting of the educational approaches in curriculum, content, pedagogy, and examinations. We'll look at some of that. Now, we got to remember that the United States rejoined UNESCO, and then Secretary of Education Rod Page, another, I think, innocent man who had speeches written for him, was just the face of this plan. He gave a speech at the UNESCO roundtable explaining that the United States is pleased to return to UNESCO. There and here, we agree that we must make education a universal reality. Our governments have entrusted us with the responsibility of preparing our children to become citizens of the world. This was the goal under Bush. So the big question for me today, well, let's finish this too, because this is important. When President Bush took office, he saw these problems, this is Rod Page speaking still, and decided to tackle them head on through a program called No Child Left Behind. Well, first of all, No Child Left Behind is not a program. That's simply the title that the Bush administration gave the reauthorization of the Secondary and Elementary Education Act, first passed in 1965 under Johnson's Great Society plans. UNESCO, through the great leadership of Director General Matsura, knows the importance, he continues, of education on a global level by coordinating the Education for All initiative. Now, what that is the national goals. That is the equivalent in America of No Child Left Behind, and it is no coincidence that both of them are to be fully in place by the end of 2014. In time for the end of the decade of education for sustainable development. Now, what about under President Barack Obama? His education plan, again, I think Arne Duncan hasn't got a clue, but he's told what to say. So what he says comes from the administration. March 31st, 2009, meeting with UNESCO World Conference on Education for Sustainable Development said, let me congratulate you. By the way, this was a statement he made, prepared and given on his behalf. Let me congratulate you on the convening of the UNESCO World Conference on Education for Sustainable Development. President Obama and I share a great interest in your important work to promote education for sustainability. Now, also, if we look at Dr. Jill Biden, wife of the vice president, in her first international tour was to speak with UNESCO at another conference, the opening session keynote on July 5th, just last month. And she had this to say. She said that UNESCO was formed 65 years ago on a simple but powerful proposition that education is essential to the better and more peaceful world. Education, in the words of Nelson Mandela, is the most powerful weapon which you can use to change the world. So this is truly about change, education for change. She went on to say, UNESCO's critical commitment to education for all, again, this is the 2009 report, is as important as ever. How can we achieve greater understanding between nations and cultures? How can we reduce poverty, famine, and disease? How can we confront climate change, reduce energy use, protect the environment, and strengthen our economies? These are all very different problems, but they all share a solution: education. These are the principles of sustainable development that you've heard all about today and are fully embedded in the education system as its goals for transformation. So let's go back and define terms. What is sustainable development? Well, the original statement is, meant for public consumption is, sustainable development is development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. Now, interestingly enough, that doesn't sound so bad. It doesn't sound like a bad goal. We're supposed to be good stewards of our resources and our environment. But when you talk about for future generations, it talks about management. And if you look at where this definition came from, it came from a report back in 1987 on the World Commission on Environment and Development. This is the report. And if you see what it consists of, a progressive transforming of the economy and society, things like international interdependence and forced community controls, redistribution, less material, and more equitable growth. In other words, sustainable development has nothing to do with sustaining development. It has everything to do with arresting development for saving the planet. And a redistribution of wealth to make everything equal for all citizens. Ensuring a sustainable level of population, merging environmental and economics and decision-making, and a new ethic that will include the relationship between man and nature above all. This is the new earth spiritism that we've hinted at a little bit. Now, you recognize some of these goals of the report in the Agenda 21 titles that Dr. Kaufman was speaking about. That's because this is where it came from. Well, let's take a picture of who our representative was from the United States, a man named William Ruckelshaus. He was the very first Environmental Protection Agency director appointed by Richard Nixon back in 1971. I believe that the Environmental Protection Agency was created as a precursor to the environmental mess we're in today, and the lies and the propaganda that's being foisted on the American public for the purpose of convincing us that the problems we face are trans-border, and therefore we need a global governance system to take care of us. Where is he today? Well, before that, he was the 1993 President Clinton's appointee to the President's Council on Sustainable Development. So he's been involved in the sustainable development movement since it was founded back in 1987. Currently, he is chairman of the World Resources Institute, a globalist non-government organization, and member of the U.S. Climate Action Partnership and sponsor of President Obama's climate change bill. So you see, not to pick on this one man, but there has been a string of authority and a string of progress with an agenda that started at least as far back as 1977. I'm only going as far back as 1987. Well, the President's Council on Sustainable Development released this report. I carry it with me because not many people believe this is true when I just quote from it. But they actually said in here that today, I mean, this is their statement, opening statement. Today, educators face a compelling responsibility to serve society by fostering the transformations needed to set us on the path to sustainable development. The time has come to ensure that the concept of education for sustainability, in the broadest sense, are discussed and woven into the framework upon which current and future educational policy is based. Goes on to explain that the North American Association for Environmental Education, working with the U.S. EPA and World Institute Resources, that's again William Ruckelshaus's organization, will build consensus towards this goal. And when consensus has been achieved, application will be made to the National Education Goals Panel for certification of the environmental education standards as national standards. Now, do you recognize the National Education Goals Panel? They are the ones who wrote the contracts that all 50 states have signed under Goals 2000 under President Clinton. This, of course, was the cover he put on the secondary and the reauthorization of the Secondary and Elementary Education Act. It's been the same document all the way through. It's just got a different cover and name on it, depending on who the president is. President Obama hasn't named his version yet, but he will name it soon. I've got my guesses what he's going to call it. But anyway, this is important because all of us don't realize, perhaps, that every single subject in education has a national curriculum standard. This is the history standards, given credit to Goals 2000 for their for coming about. It is the social studies standards, also from Goals 2000. It is the national content standards in economics, also from Goals 2000. It is the national standards for civic and government, written by the Center for Civic Education, one of the primary exposés in Allen's book, Fed Ed. Very important piece of this that I'll end my talk on. But let's go back once again to Shirley McCune so that you can all hear her tell us this back in 1989 at the National Governors Conference.
What is happening in America today and what is happening in Kansas and the
Great... I'm going to turn it up.
Simply a chance situation than the usual winds of change. What it amounts to is a total transformation of our society. And the issue for most children and the issues for the society is that what has changed in education today is that we no longer see the teaching of facts and information as the primary outcome of education.
Now, she said two pieces here. You missed part of the first one. Her first point was that the purpose of education is the total transformation of society. Now, you can look at the National Standards for Social Studies and see the same thing as their goal. Their goal is, first of all, to say it's clear that the dominant social and economic and cultural and scientific trends, that's practically the acronym for UNESCO. have defined the Western world for five centuries is leading in new directions. Now, what idea, what worldview has dominated Western civilization, if not the principles of Christianity that gave birth to freedom? That is now moving in new directions, according to this book. So what is the purpose of social studies? The primary purpose is to help young people develop as citizens of a culturally diverse, democratic society in an interdependent world. This is the meaning of outcome-based education. What do we want our children to believe? What do we want them to think? What ideas do we want to fill their heads with? Now let's use the curriculum as necessary to get us there. That's why we no longer have history classes in our schools. We now have social studies, social outcome-based studies, where history is only used as necessary to prop up the social outcome-based goal. Now, the myth of No Child Left Behind was that it ended Goals 2000. It actually just ejected the booster rockets that put the thing in orbit. What it did was hold states and districts accountable to previously signed contracts. All 50 states have signed the Goals 2000 and other contracts we'll talk about. It holds schools accountable. You ever notice that during the whole No Child Left Behind, it was, we want to hold schools accountable. They never finished the system. To whom and to what? They never finished the system because that was where the truth lie. The National Assessment Governing Board's policy mandates that the content of the NAEP test reflect voluntary national standards. Folks, when you mandate something that's voluntary, it's no longer voluntary. I'm going to throw a caution flag on that one. Voluntary now means mandatory. Now, what about President Obama's plan to change, read that, continue, enforcing conformity? Well, his plan, as Alan touched on, was just released, the smoking gun. We didn't talk about this. We both found it the same day. The remarks on education, July 24th. He explains that the race to the top of grant awards, over $4 billion, he says, these are his words, rather than divvying it up and handing it out, we are letting states and school districts compete for it. If you set and enforce rigorous and challenging standards and assessments, your state can win. Your state can have the money if you enforce these rigorous standards. He goes on to say, with the race to the top fund, we will reward states that come together and adopt a common set of standards and assessments. In other words, the same thing in every state and every school. We'll prove that even more. And already, he says, 46 states are working to develop such standards. Not Alaska, thank you very much, Sarah Palin. I urge those 46 states to finish the job and the other four to get on board. Clearly, this has been an agenda that has started long before